Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
The Apostles of Infinite Love is a religious group mainly active in Quebec and Guadeloupe. It was founded by a French priest who claimed to be inspired by messages from the Virgin Mary. This order exists and operates under its own hierarchy. Its faith, doctrine, tradition, and practices are predominantly Catholic Christian, with the Spirit of Jesus Christ inspiring it. This controversial religious order is endeavoring to return to the evangelical simplicity and purity of the early days of Christianity. This is the Apostles of Infinite Love on today's episode of Cult Following. Hi, Dr. Katie. Welcome back to Cult Following.
Hey, Todd. Welcome back to you as well. I guess I'm the one that should be welcomed back more, but I appreciate the welcome.
I missed you. I missed you on season two. I had to work with a bunch of other
hosts. I missed you. I think you had some great great hosts, great fill-ins while I was out, and I appreciate your patience with everything, and I'm really, really excited to be back.
Well, I'm happy to have you back. For those of you who weren't aware, Dr. Katie was off doing her doctor stuff for season two. So we had a great season one, and then I had to have some fill-in hosts. And now after a long absence from recording any of these, almost a year, it's been almost a year since there's been an episode out, you're back. And you're back for the season, and we have a lot of really cool stuff coming up. Are you as excited for season three as I am?
I am very excited. I'm pretty stoked, honestly. We have so many good topics to cover, so many good, interesting cults to talk about. Some of which might be debatable about how people feel regarding whether or not they are cults. I'm really excited. I'm happy to be back. We've got, a lot of good episodes, so things should be a lot more consistent as well. So I'm excited.
Well, what's really fascinating for me is that even though we haven't recorded a new episode in almost a year, our following has actually grown. We actually have more listeners from around the world. It's stayed out there, and we're in the top 15 of best cult podcasts.
Wow.
So hopefully we continue this going into the new season. But the biggest change we have for season three is we've added a third host.
Yay.
Do you want to welcome our new host to the show officially right now, Dr. Katie? I'll let you do that.
I would. So our third host that we're bringing on is the lovely and intelligent and articulate Lisa Thomas. So welcome, Lisa.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you on the show. Now, I've known Lisa for a long time, and I've wanted to work with her for so long. We haven't found the right project, and then this became it. And we wanted to have a third host for a number of reasons. First off, Dr. Katie and I are both super busy. Dr. Katie is still, deep in her practice. I produce 7 podcasts now. I host several of them and co-host several of them. And we wanted to be able to have a dynamic where we could work with different groups. So for those listening, we will have all three of us in many, many, many of these episodes with three uniquely different opinions, I believe. And there will be combinations where it's just Dr. Katie and I, the OG crew, versions of the show with me and Lisa, and certainly some that'll just be Dr. Katie and Lisa. So I think you're going to hear a lot of different perspectives as you go through the season. I think everyone's really going to like the trio of us, the trinity of the three of us.
Yeah, that's a perfect thing to bring up for what we're going to talk about today.
But let's, you know, let's let everyone get to know Lisa a little bit, right? So, Lisa, what's your attraction to the world of cults? Tell us about that. How'd you get interested in this kind of stuff?
I think it's what's fascinating to me is what would pull people in. And once they're in, what kind of would make them stay? Like, what is the attraction?
Yeah.
I just think it's fascinating on how they get pulled into it. I think it's easy for everybody to say that would never happen to me. But I think a lot of people that are pulled in probably felt the exact same way before they were involved in a cult.
Sure. And you and I, we share an interest. And I think Dr. Katie Hughes, to some extent, we love to get on Netflix and Hulu. And we like to watch the documentaries. Watch these train wrecks, you know, which is usually how they get a documentary, right? There was some train wreck component to it. What are you watching now? What have you watched recently that's really grabbed you? I know you watch Wild Wild Country because we both watched that.
Yeah, that was a really good one. The one that I'm excited about seeing, I haven't watched it yet, is the new one that just came out on Twin Flames, because I think that would just attract a lot of people, finding your partner or your twin flame. I think that could pull a really diverse, that could pull anybody in, no matter your background.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think most of the listeners know that, you know, all, at least Dr. Katie and I were from the Midwest, Lisa also from the Midwest. And, you know, in that Louisville metropolitan area, Southern Indiana, Northern Kentucky, a lot of cults, a lot of controversial churches and religions in that area. It's really interesting how much stuff comes out of the Midwest.
I would like to think I'm not gullible enough to be pulled into a cult, but I might be nosy enough.
That makes sense. I think curiosity killed the cat. I was just going to say, it's so wild how those cults fly under the radar, right? I think unless you're looking for that specifically, or maybe in the right place at the right time, you would not necessarily think that that region of the country has that many cults, or that they did at some time.
Well, you know, you can drive through your county, wherever, you know, you're in Kentucky, Katie, Lisa, Southern Indiana, just drive through your county and look at all the pole barn churches. Just look at all those Baptist, Christian, whatever they are. There's a whole lot of churches that aren't really brick and mortar buildings, you know? So you can definitely tell, you know, the Methodist church or the Lutheran church or the Catholic church, a lot of money in those buildings. There's a lot of pole barn churches with pastors, and you really have to wonder what that congregation is about, what they're putting together there, you know? And those are the ones you hear a lot of scandals come from. And I think sometimes the cults can begin like that, you know? Could be as simple as that. And I think the further out you get in the country, the more often that could happen. Does this make sense to you all?
It does. I think for me, you know, what you're touching on is what we talk about maybe every episode, you know, at what point does something that is maybe more traditional or accepted become something that is more of an outlier or starts to diverge from that categorization and become what we would consider a cult? And there's a lot of nuance to that. And it's interesting to think about how those things develop.
For sure. Lisa, do you have a comment?
No, I mean, kind of along with what Dr. Katie said, I think it's just interesting on where exactly people put the line and when is that line crossed in these? Like, when does it go from just, a church to a cult?
Sure. Lisa, did you grow up spiritual or religious?
I did. I grew up as a Christian, mostly in non-denominational churches, but there was a few years we went to a Baptist church. I never really fit in there. I would always get in trouble at summer camp and stuff because my shorts were above my knees, and I was always the one that was getting scolded. Like I couldn't go to the lake or the pool parties because I had a bikini. So it was funny. I was always kind of the bad kid.
And is religion in your life now? I don't know if I've ever asked you this.
Yeah, it is. It is still very much a part of my life. I haven't made it to church as often as I would like to, but I definitely pray every day, and it's a big part of my life.
That's great. That's great. Well, today we have the Apostles of Infinite Love. So, Lisa, you have a little background on this cult. Do you want to go ahead and tell us a little about it? What'd you put together?
Sure. So, the Apostles of Infinite Love is a traditionalist, independent, Catholic, religious group active in various parts of the world, with its headquarters being in Quebec. It was founded by Michel Coulon, a French priest and self-proclaimed Pope Clement XV, saying he was inspired by messages from the Virgin Mary. The group was also led by Jean Gaston Tremblay, also known as John Gregory of the Trinity or Gregory the 17th. He had a lot of names, apparently. The Catholic sect has attracted traditionalist Catholics unhappy and discontent with the modernizing changes made during the Second Vatican Council.
Let's talk about this for a second before we move on, because I want to make sure everyone is clear about what the Second Vatican Council was, because it's something for Catholics. I'm Catholic. It's still something that's a sore spot for us. So I want to tell everyone a little bit about what a Catholic sect is and why they kind of happened, because they didn't really happen much before then. And if they did, it was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But the distinction is this: a Catholic sect is a nonconformist Catholic church. That's basically what it is. So it's a sect of a larger group, but because it has somewhat different practices, it really can't be called Catholic. And the reason why is because they're not governed under a diocese. So they can hold a Christian designation rather than a Catholic one. This group calls itself a Catholic sect. Funny story, Mel Gibson has a Catholic sect. The actor Mel Gibson, his church, his Catholic church in Los Angeles, is technically a sect. He's not governed under the diocese. So weird, right? Mel Gibson might be running a Catholic cult up there for all we know. I don't think so. It's hardcore Latin Catholic, but you know, but it's here. There is a distinction for sure, right? So these types of cults, these Catholic sects became popular after the Second Vatican Council. And the Second Vatican Council, which was in 1962, really dealt with the relations between the Catholic Church and the modern world. And it was very unpopular, as I said. One of the goals of Vatican II was to provide clarity on the topic of the role of the Church in relation to the world at large. For a long time, the Catholic Church operated as a microcosm in and of itself, self-governing. And what they did was what they did, and that's all there was. There was nothing else. So they wanted to kind of modernize with the change of culture. So it was decided that the church needed an update to its procedures to become more relevant and accessible to the modern people. And I'm just going to touch on a few of the important changes that happened in the Catholic Church at that time. And the most important one, and the one that really has people fired up more than anything, is the liturgy. And what happened was they really wanted to start to deliver the Mass in the native language of where it was at. The Catholic Church was all over the world. It had traditionally always been performed in Latin, which if you've ever been to a Latin Mass, and a lot of times maybe you have a wedding or something like that, where maybe there's been a Latin Mass, even a funeral, they're beautiful. It's really amazing. But Latin became a dead language. So one of the things that church wanted to do was to now present Mass in the native language of the area that you were at. A lot of people don't like that. Also, they wanted to expand what the Mass would cover, and they wanted to add in more Old Testament readings. The Christians follow the New Testament. There's not a lot of Old Testament stuff that they would get into, but it became more acceptable to get into that kind of stuff. And part of the reason of that was their relation to the Jews. And I think this is, you know, when we wrote this, we didn't know when we would be recording this episode that there would be this Israel-Palestine thing going on, and how just upended the world would be right now in terms of who's the hero and who's the villains in this, because it's so gray. Maybe I don't even know if gray is the word I want to use, but no one can really figure. There's just so many atrocities happening right now that people you thought were good guys now are perceived as bad guys. You just don't know what's happening here. You can't define it. But an interesting thing is that you have to remember that the Second Vatican Council met in 1962. So, you know, you're looking at just under 20 years after after World War II. World War II, the Vatican was silent on the issue of Jews being massacred. Very interesting facet to this. They didn't weigh in on it. Everyone knew that this Holocaust was happening. The Catholics wouldn't weigh in on it. And many people thought it was because they just, the Jews weren't the chosen people, right? So they just let it happen. Now the Vatican has sort of told a different narrative in that they didn't speak up on the Holocaust because they were in the middle of a fascist country, because Italy was part of, you know, the kind of the Axis powers there. So you couldn't be this, you couldn't be Vatican City and be making an uproar about what you're doing is wrong, because you won't be Vatican City for very long. So that's what the Vatican says now. That's how they're sort of rewriting the story. And I think part of Vatican II was, you know, let's mend our relationship with the Jews because we didn't really participate in World War II. So the Jews should not be presented as rejected by God, and the new covenant is not possible without Abraham's people. So just to kind of give everyone just a little short rundown of what Vatican II was about, there's lots of other stuff, relations with other religions. The Catholic Church quit saying stuff like Hinduism isn't real, you know, Buddhism isn't real. They would embrace them all. If you're following a God, we're okay with it, is what they would say. So many of these Catholic sects came about because they just really weren't happy with that stuff, which to me says there was some reason why. There's some method of hate in here, some method of traditionalism that they wanted to keep. I think this is the beginning of the stew of why this sect became a sect, why they didn't want to adhere to the bigger policies of the bosses that were in Vatican City. I don't know if I'm off base on that, Dr. Katie, but I do see the initial ingredients starting to come together on why they needed to be a sect. No one needs to be above us telling us what to do. And there's a reason for that. Why?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think you both have some information on the leaders of this sect. So I'm going to let you two talk about these gentlemen that started this thing. And then we're going to dig into this further and see if there's more ingredients to add.
Okay. So the Frenchman Michel Coulin was born in the village of Lorraine in 1905 and was ordained a priest in 1935. But just 1 year later, in 1936, he announced that he had been ordained a bishop by Christ himself. He founded a community called the Order of the Mother of God in response to a request made by the Blessed Virgin Mary. In 1950, he announced that he had been crowned Pope and had taken the name Clement XV. The actual Pope, Pope Pius XII, punished him in 1951 and publicly declared him by name the one who should be avoided and excommunicated him from the church.
So Jean-Gaston Tremblay was born in 1928 in Quebec. He was raised Catholic and moved to Montreal at 16, where he joined the Brothers of St. John of God. In 1952, he received permission to form his own community, which he called the Congregation of Jesus and Mary. The community moved from town to town for a number of years before settling in Quebec in 1958. So Jean-Gaston Tremblay was also known as John Gregory of the Trinity, or Gregory the 17th. In 1961, he met Michel Coulon, and the two decided to merge their communities into one called the Apostles of Infinite Love, which is what we are talking about today. So Tremblay stated that Coulon was the man he saw in a vision he had 12 years prior, which had the face of a future pope chosen directly by God. The following year, Coulon consecrated Tremblay a bishop.
Their community grew rapidly in the first years of the Second Vatican Council, exceeding 300 people in 1966. Throughout the 1960s, the Apostles of Infinite Love protested against the changes in the Catholic Church, as well as the secularization occurring in Canada, especially issues related to the change of gender roles and the increasing numbers of schools and hospitals that moved from church to government. After the election of Pope Paul VI in the Catholic Church, Michel Coulon denounced him as the anti-pope. In 1967, Coulon announced that he had been divinely instructed to bypass Tremblay as his designated successor but in 1968, Tremblay declared that he had mystically been made pope under the name of Gregory the 17th. And in the following year, Coulon acknowledged that Tremblay was now pope.
So Coulon died in 1974, and in France, his movement broke up into different factions. In Guadalupe, the Apostles of Infinite Love established two convents, including one at Pointe-à-Pitre, which became a place of pilgrimage after a girl in 1977 claimed to see a Marian apparition. The Canadian group continues using the name Apostles of Infinite Love and is also known by the names Order of the Magnificent Mother of God and Order of the Apostles of the Latter Times. It's also known by other similar names around the world. Today, this religious order possesses charters in the United States, Puerto Rico, Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, and Ecuador. It is recognized in Guadalupe and in France, and established in Italy, in Argentina, and in South Africa, all under the name of the Order of the Magnificent Mother of God. Tremblay died in 2011, and the church's Pope Gregory the 18th was crowned in 2012.
So we have to take a minute to unpack all this. Sounds like a little infighting right out of the gate, with each wanting to kind of take over positions from the other. It's a little odd, but Dr. Katie, first, let's address the visions. I think one of the first things I want to jump into here. Visions of Jesus, messages from Mary by Coulon. Even Tremblay's vision of Coulon as the Pope. So I know as a doctor, you're not really going to venture a guess in whether this is divine. You know, there's no medical thing for that. But is this symptomatic of something else? Are these visions... Could it be work of fiction? Is it just for them to build a cult? Do you think they're really having visions? What would you say if someone came into you and said, I'm having these visions?
I think context is important. And so in this context, we have to think about, you know, was this something that was a symptom of a possible psychological disorder? Or is this just something that was used as a manipulation tactic or an excuse to start this separate sect, this cult, or is it a combination of both things? So, you know, reading through this and learning about it, I can touch on a couple of different things. So, you know, the visions, and, you know, saying that they were anointed by Mary and that kind of thing, it sounds a lot like the inflated self-esteem or grandiosity that we might see in bipolar disorder, for instance. But then again, grandiosity is also a big part of other disorders that we talk about pretty frequently on this podcast, like narcissistic personality disorder. So, you know, this grandiose sense of self-importance is what comes up with that. And I think, you know, it depends. It depends on how we're viewing this. And, you know, we're just going on the information that we have. You know, I think,
yeah,
another thing that I considered was he actually hearing or seeing things, right? Were there actual hallucinations happening? Because then that's going to steer me a little more towards, well, was this a psychotic disorder, versus that? And then given the time period, right, were there any drugs involved? Was that a possibility? I know that this is, you know, a Catholic sect, but we can't necessarily rule that out unless we know for sure. So, you know, what was impacting cognition in these individuals? And those are kind of my thoughts.
I think, and I want to follow up with something else with that, but I just want to interject this really quick. I thought it was interesting. What Lisa said was what the Pope had said about him. So not only did Michel Coulon denounce one of the popes as an anti-pope, but one of the other popes had told him, had kind of just sort of blackballed them, you know? What was the quote? What was it, Lisa, that the Pope said, one who should be avoided? Well, I can't remember what you said.
Yeah,
it was.
I think that was it.
While she's finding that, I'm going to go ahead and ask you the next question. A person naming themselves a pope, is this simply a title for an organization? Is it as simple as that? Is it narcissistic behavior? Is it delusional? Especially when there's already a pope, you know? I don't go around calling myself president of the United States. I might think it, but right. I never say it. I don't just go out in the world and be like, I'm the president of the United States now, you know? Like, is it, what is that? Is it nothing? Am I making nothing out of it?
I definitely would not say it's nothing. I think that, the big question is, does this person believe it? Do they actually believe that they are the one and only rightful pope? Right? Are they denouncing everything else? Do they believe it? Or is this something that they're possibly using as a manipulation tactic, something that is going to help create that power differential that they need to create a following and create a cult or their own version of this religion? So I think, it definitely sounds a lot like something that we would see in narcissistic personality disorder, like we just talked about. But I think the big question is, does this person believe it? And maybe it's a little bit of both.
Right, right. I want to tell you all a story. I don't know if you ever heard this story or not. Did you ever hear about the Pope of Kentucky? Are you familiar with that?
Kate, I do not remember this, no. So this was very interesting.
Okay. So this was Pope Dan Johnson. This was a big news story. You can Google this and see this story. But Dan Johnson was a colorful state lawmaker in Kentucky who ran a controversial biker-style church called the Heart of Fire Church, which was in Louisville, where he was known as the Pope. So he was the Pope of his religion in his biker bar/church, which was literally a church with a bar attached to it. I've been to this church before. Wow. I've seen this church. And haven't been in the church, seen the church, which is, I believe, closed now. I think it's closed now. So he was a self-proclaimed pope in his religion at his biker bar while being a state legislator.
That seems like a conflict.
Quite an interesting combination there.
Don't we love Kentucky?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
So, according to the Associated Press, Johnson sponsored a number of bills having to do with religious liberty and teaching the Bible in public schools and all that kind of stuff. Dan Johnson was also accused of making racist remarks on his Facebook page and was accused and investigated for sexually assaulting a teenage girl in his home basement. He denied these allegations, but died by suicide shortly thereafter, after the investigation was launched and the resulting media attention. He killed himself, went out in a field and blew his brains out. That's what he did. Literally pulled his car over in one of those big fields in Kentucky, walked out in the field, killed himself. They found him like 3 days later. I actually met the girl who accused him of molesting her, and I knew Dan Johnson's daughter. So I knew two of the people involved in this. I don't know if I can venture a guess either way, from, just from knowing them and hearing this story, about whether this was real or not. I never knew Dan Johnson at all. I never met him. But I just, I'm a degree away from it, and I still don't really have an opinion on it. Family's family. They're going to support their father. The girl that was the alleged victim. I don't know. I don't know if her story's real or not. It could have just been something to destroy him. I really can't tell. Dr. Katie's probably more qualified to get to the bottom of that than me. But I will tell you an interesting story that a friend of mine had in this church. So a male friend of mine liked Dan Johnson's daughter, my friend, Rebecca. And he went to the Heart of Fire Church to go to the bar. They would have these biker meetups, and my friend went there. And he got roofied while he was there. But the roofie was meant for Pope Dan Johnson's daughter. So they had roofied her drink. Someone in the bar had roofied her drink. Maybe the bartender, maybe a biker that handed her the drink. No one really knows who. She didn't want the drink, handed it to my friend. My friend drank it, got roofied, woke up in the church pew the next morning. So that's the kind of seedy, weird shit that was going on in this place anyways. I don't know, think this is related probably to Dan Johnson and these accusations, or whether Dan killing himself was it an implication of guilt? I don't know. But it is a very interesting story from a person who named themselves a Pope, so I thought I'd share that today.
That sounds really troubling. I mean, I will say, you know, if that's the kind of thing that was happening, there's at least a pattern there, and it does not lead me to believe that good things were taking place. So,
but look up that story. I want to know from you two, is committing suicide in the field, is that an implication of guilt? I mean, a truly innocent person would weather the media firestorm and have their day at court. What do you think?
I think it could personally go either way. I feel like I know some people that might be so offended by that they wouldn't want to face it. They wouldn't want, even if, you know, half the people believe that they really didn't do it, they probably don't want their spouse or their kids or their cousins or their family or their church or their whoever thinking that they did and couldn't face it.
Yeah. Katie?
I think when people complete suicide, there can be a number of different reasons. And so it's hard to assume why, right? I mean, like Lisa said, maybe it's because it's going to stain their name regardless of if the allegations are true or not. Maybe they actually did it and that shame and guilt is catching up with them. And so they don't see another way out. Maybe they don't actually care either way. And so they just think, okay, well, I'm about to get in trouble for this. I'd rather just not be here. And it doesn't necessarily matter to me. And this is the easier way to not be here. But it's always touchy, I think, and hard to pin down unless you are the person themselves.
That implication of guilt is fascinating to me. I remember when Michael Jackson was kind of being hounded for molesting kids, he made a settlement. And a lot of people believe that him settling and not going to court was an admission of guilt. How do you feel about that? How does that relate? Do you think he just wanted to stop from a PR perspective? Let's just stop the madness now and I'll pay these people whatever they want so we can get on with whatever's next? Or is that buying them off so he doesn't go to prison? Is it the same? Is it different? What do you think?
I think it's kind of the same. My take on that would be that it's also, you're never going to know unless you are those people that are directly involved, right? It could be either one, but unless you know all the facts and you were one of the people that was involved or there, then it's just pure speculation, right? Because either option is valid and could have been what actually happened. We just don't know.
Right. Right. Well, there were certainly controversies with the Apostles of Infinite Love. I'm going to talk about a few of those. Initially, the Apostles of Infinite Love consisted only of men, but by the late 60s, it included whole families. And this prompted the Social Welfare Court of St. Jerome to rule that it was an unsuitable environment for children, and 17 children were taken and handed over to social workers. But Tremblay went into hiding with 55 other people from the church, leading him to be listed as one of the 10 most wanted men in Quebec. So already, ingredients of something bad going on here. From 1978 to 2001, the movement was sued because of alleged abuses, including rape, extortion, and sexual abuse. Its rejection of the world contributed to it being labeled a cult by the media. And for over 40 years, Tremblay was the subject of numerous police investigations into charges of kidnapping, illegal detention, and child abuse. One former member filed a civil suit for $2.5 million in 2001, claiming physical and sexual abuse. Tremblay also served 6 months in prison in 1977 for defying an order to hand over the boy and his sister to authorities. Also in 2001, Tremblay and two others were charged with multiple counts of abuse dating back more than 30 years, but that case was dropped. Most of this cult's locations were communal, and many of the children within the organization were never allowed any contact with the outside world. Many of those kids that are out of the religion now still struggle to function in the world. So, Katie, how does communal living affect children? I think that's kind of the first piece to look at here.
So, I mean, just firstly, I want to say there, it seems like there was some pretty solid evidence if he was sentenced to prison and children were being taken by, you know, Child Protective Services or whatever the equivalent of that would be in Quebec. And that's just awful. And so, unfortunately, this is something that seems to happen a lot, at least with the cults that we talk about. That are more problematic. I think, you know, this children that are in communal living situations are of particular interest in an area where we really need more research. There's not a ton of research on communal living and the impact on children. There's a lot of research on abuse and trauma on children and development. But, you know, this kind of population or environment is something that would be interesting to see more research on, just because that, you know, if you're living with a group of people, it depends, right? Is the care considered either a risk or is it a protective factor? And that depends on the quality of care provided a lot of the time. And so, you know, if children aren't being provided the quality of care that they need to flourish and develop appropriately, then that's going to end up being a huge problem for them that continues throughout their life, unfortunately. You know, there, like I said, there wasn't a lot of research. But there was, you know, some that touched on that need for security and support versus their need for greater autonomy. And so that security and support is important to that environment and that communal living.
Sure. And, you know, we were talking about the kind of that implication of guilt. Do you think when Tremblay went into hiding, why would you do that? There was nothing to hide, right? So an implication that maybe there was some level of abuse. I also, you know, I don't know how it works in Canada versus in America, but for the kids to be taken away anyways, there had to be some evidence to support there was some level of abuse.
Yes, I would, based on the information that we have, I would say with almost 100% certainty there. I mean, I'm not as familiar with the court system in Quebec, but you know, there's got to be some level of evidence that you have to meet to be able to meet, to be able to charge someone with that and have them be convicted and go to prison. And so it seems to me that it happened. I'm definitely going to side with the victim and the children.
Lisa, do you have a question?
Well, I don't have a question, maybe just more of a comment. So I think something really interesting about most cult leaders is that they want to be more important than they actually are. And I think it's really interesting with this Michel Coulon that he's like, okay, you know, I was ordained a priest, I'm a priest. And he's like, well, that's not really getting me what I want. So now I'm a bishop. Well, now, you know, the Virgin Mary was talking to me and now I'm going to be Pope. And he's just like, constantly giving himself promotions and titles and just like so desperate to feel more important than he actually is or to get the attention that he's seeking, I guess.
For sure. I can see that. That's why I'm the first host of the show. Katie is the second host of the show. Lisa is the third host of the show because someone has to be number one.
Right.
I have some examples of things that were going on here. So feel free to jump in and let's discuss these as I kind of point them out. One member describes being moved constantly around the United States without being able to settle in one place for too long. Katie, kids, military kids, maybe Lisa can even respond to this. moving around from state to state, maybe not making friends or whatever, is that what happens to a young child when they do that? Do you know?
I mean, anything that disrupts a child's level of stability is going to have an impact, right? And the good thing is that children are very resilient. As people, we tend to be pretty resilient, actually. Even in the face of trauma, there's a really high level of resilience, but that it depends on the person as well, right? And so I think, you know, not having that stability is going to impact a child, right? They're, if they don't have those relationships that they're able to cultivate over years' time, and they're constantly moving, then that might bring up some potential issues for insecurity and possibly anxiety and possibly even some attachment issues developmentally as they grow.
A former member says he was always cut off from outsiders and was sometimes forced to hide behind a false wall inside a closet. What kind of comments do you have on that?
I mean, that just sounds like horrific abuse. I mean, again, this is pretty extreme, right? This is not just moving from place to place and having to reestablish friendships and relationships and, you know, be a part of clubs and be the new person every time. This is, you are not going to have any social interaction or contact. And to the point where you are going to be hidden behind a wall in a closet so that no one else knows that you're there. And so you would obviously assume that that would have a pretty big negative impact on one's psyche.
One lawsuit alleges that isolation and the apostles' teachings that she should forget her parents and give herself to God marred her ability to form relationships. How would you address that?
So I'm just rereading it. I think it just goes along with what we've been talking about.
When you tell someone to forget their parents, I mean, that's the part that's we've talked about the isolation, but telling someone to forget their parents and give herself to God.
That sounds very manipulative to me. I mean, a lot of this is obviously kind of wrapped in manipulation and masked as something different, but that to me, especially, it's like, okay, well, these are your caregivers and people that you love and you're supposed to trust. And you're being told that the only person that you should trust is not even actually a physical entity, right? And so what does that mean for how you're able to manipulate your interactions with children, especially if you're telling them, well, yeah, those are your parents, but there's something else that you can't necessarily see that I also kind of represent that is above them. Right. And so that's very confusing.
Yeah. Sure. Another lawsuit also described repeated beatings. One member says he was sometimes plunged into a barrel of cold water as punishment for wetting his bed. And this is his quote: "My punishment every single time is they would take my feet and put me head first, back and forth, back and forth. And if I cried or moved too much, they would just put me back longer." An example of the abuse that was there. One member was sexually molested by the so-called priest who heard his confession, and again by the leader of the Apostles of Infinite Love. So one person describing a sexual molestation. All the hallmarks of those 60s era cults are here. You know, it's, you know, got some basis in religion somewhere, some spirituality. There's a free love system happening. It started with men, evolved into women and families. We've seen exploitation of children like this. We saw this with the Branch Davidians and David Koresh, things like this. And also Christian, remember that, you know, that all the Waco stuff, the Branch Davidians, that was Christian, but they were taking child brides, multiple brides, all kinds of, you know, things going on there that they felt were right. So this is a kind of a quintessential, stew of what we see from these 60s era cults, in my opinion. How do you guys feel about it? Let's kind of close with our final thoughts.
Gosh, I think, I know this is a hard one. I mean, they're all difficult, but I think this just, there are so many examples of abuse and specific types of abuse, especially by children. It makes it really difficult. You know, it makes me wonder, the more we go through these, and you're talking about the connections that kind of run through all of these type of cults, you know, is it this need for power and admiration and influence over other people, feeling important, that kind of thing? Or is it a cover to be able to engage in sexual abuse of children on some level, right? You have to ask that. And I feel like we would be remiss if we didn't think about that. You know, and maybe, again, a lot of times it's likely both, but I just wonder what the actual underlying driving force was, you know, and they were able to kind of create their own level of secrecy by sectioning themselves off from the main church in order to do this. It's devastating.
We don't have any data on whether the church had any wealth. So I think when you move into an area of setting up a church, many times there's a motivation for money. Sometimes the pastors in these pole barn churches are living pretty high on the hog, you know, and there's a lot of donations, a lot of passing the hat. And all they have to do is give their sermons and tell everyone how to, you know, live a good life, read right from the Bible. They're not even publishing material. They're reading from material that's already there. Where a lot of cults will actually create their own doctrines, write their own stuff. You know, they're just reading the Old Testament, the New Testament. That's all they're doing. They're reading something that's already there. They're charismatic. They make money. Or it's for something else. So maybe it's a cover. Maybe all the religious stuff's a cover just to get access to these families and these kids. I know you bring up a good point, though. I'd be curious in our research of these over time, whether we see money as the factor or, you know, some level of abuse as a factor, would be interesting to see. Lisa, what do you think about all this in general? What do you think of the Apostles of Infinite Love?
Anytime anything like this involves children, I think it makes it harder. And I mean, it's just devastating. It's really sad to think about. And you think about those kids and like keeping them from making friends or any attachments or really any outside influences, it allows you more control over them. And it could allow you to kind of do what you want as children. And then as they get older, then you could go after them for other things like money. You know, if you want to be a good Christian or if you want to be a good person or if you're going to do this, then we need your money or we need your house or we need this or you need to give more and we need more of your time and you need to, you know, volunteer more. And really just it kind of like starting it as kids, it makes like a lifelong captive.
Sure.
I don't know. It's just sad on a lot of levels.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Well, we leave it to you, the audience, to decide what you think the Apostles of Infinite Love is. I think we've gone through it thoroughly enough today. This is, you know, again, it's far too common of a tale. And this won't be the only cult we get into this year that has similar features. And I think it's just like it's a addition subtraction game with a lot of these. Add a little money. Take away the minors, just add a doctrine here, you know, and they all really sort of orbit the same type of thing. I'd like to think that people start these things with good intentions, but it may not be the case. These may be started with.
That's really I was going to say, you have much more faith in humanity than I do.
That's very optimistic.
Which is odd for me to say that, right? Anyways, Lisa, we're glad to have you. We're glad you got this episode. I don't know if this one's going to air first, But this is Lisa's first time on our show. So, everyone, I hope you're happy with her. And Lisa, do you want to take us out?
Sure. So thanks for listening, everyone. Be sure to rate and review this episode. You can find us on Facebook at the Cult Following Podcast and on Instagram at Join the Cult Following. If you have questions or comments for us, you can send them to jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com.
All right. All right, until perfect. Next time.
Have a good night, everyone.
Keep following.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Everybody, I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith, and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.